welcome to this Wednesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us today. Coming up in just a bit, protecting farmers when the Fargo-Moorhead flood diversion is used, and running 480 miles to honor babies gone far too soon. We'll learn about Haven and its work ensuring grieving families never have to walk alone. And we open today with another edition of Prairie Plates with many things to do right here in North Dakota.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Eon. This week, Prairie Plates comes to you in the form of a book. And we have an author in who just wrote a book called 100 Things to Do in North Dakota Before You Die. But before we talk to her, I would like to show some gratitude for the folks at Rustica Eatery and Tavern in Moorhead. They've announced they're going to close at the end of August, and it's just a great restaurant. And I just wanted to express some appreciation for the years of service to the Fargo-Moorhead community. But something a little more positive, which is this new book by Alicia Underlie Nelson, who's a familiar name in the Prairie Public studio. Or Alicia, welcome to my foodio. You've been here before, but tell listeners a little bit about yourself before we talk about your new book.
Sure. I am a West Fargo-based travel writer and journalist. I specialize in undervisited and maybe under-the-radar places all over the world, with a special emphasis on the Midwest and the Prairie Provinces of Canada. And that grew out of a real hatred for the term flyover country a couple of years ago. And I just thought, you know, there's so many excellent places that people don't even know about. So I kind of made it my mission to explore and tell those stories, and I haven't stopped since.
Alicia, give us a preview about your new book, 100 Things to Do in North Dakota Before You Die. It seems like it's a fun bucket list of places to hang out in North Dakota.
It is. I had a blast writing it. I tell people the writing of this book took about a year, but the research for the book took about 13, because it's really a compilation of all the places that I've been and the people that I've met and the experiences that I've had. So it shares some of those top tourist attractions that maybe we who live here in North Dakota go to occasionally, but usually only when we have friends or family visiting us, right? So maybe there's some spots that we haven't seen yet. And there's also some locals-only places that travelers completely miss. And that's kind of the problem if you're going even to an unfamiliar part of the state. You might hit the highlights, you might hit the big cities, but there's going to be small towns, there's going to be destinations, there's going to be those cool spots off the gravel road or that mom and pop cafe that is just not on your radar. And, you know, there's still lots of places that are doing really great food, really great experiences that maybe don't even have a website yet. So it's really my job to find those spots for people and to organize them in a way that they can get good inspiration, spark some new ideas, kind of point them in the right direction so they can find their own adventures. So it's really nice. It's detailed by attraction type. So there's a section for sports and recreation, art and culture, shopping and fashion, food and drink, those kind of things. You can also search by itinerary. So if you're looking for family-friendly destinations, top outdoor experiences, architecture buffs, art fans, that kind of thing. You can also search the index in the back by city, or you can search seasonally, which is nice too. I was just out in Minot and had a lot of chats with people that were wondering what to do in North Dakota in the winter. Well, then you just flip to the back, you start with some good winter ideas and work from there. So it's really set up for folks that maybe like to read listicles or like to get their travel information online in short little bursts. It's like that. I tell people it's not a narrative structured story. You can pick it up, you can read what you're interested in. And the idea is that you can keep this in the glove compartment of your car or, you know, in the seat back pocket and use it as some inspiration. Call up your friends, tell them to meet you somewhere to have this really cool experience.
And Prairie Plates is a food segment, so we're going to get into the food and drink section a little bit here. I noticed that you featured Cottonwood Cider House near Ayer, North Dakota. I really like that there are a lot of hidden gems in this book.
The food section, the food and drink section, was the most challenging for me to write because I really wanted to include so many different things. So I really had to focus down and think what is really unique about this area, what is historic, and what is culturally relevant. And ideally, I want to cover all three. And one thing that really popped out at me, I mean, you talked about Cottonwood Cider House, is that there are so many people doing really interesting things with local ingredients. You know, they have an orchard there. They grow their own apples, and there's just a very quick step. I mean, it's steps from orchard to glass, which is really interesting and really unique, and not every place has that opportunity for you to drink something super local, to have really great food, and to dine on site on a family farm. And there's lots of great opportunities to do that in North Dakota that I think sometimes if you spend all your life in the city, you just don't know about. So, I mean, you can have wine from local wineries. I profile a few, Colfax, Fargo, and Mapleton in the east, all the way to Burlington in the west to get people started. One of my favorite experiences in the book, too, was meeting the dairy cows that supply the milk for the gelato and the Gouda at Cows & Co. Creamery. That was really cool. You know, so I've had that at Brujala. But to go to the farm where it's actually made and to actually see the cows, her family actually, you know, raises those cows. So it's just like that next step that I think North Dakota does really well, like going a little bit deeper. And I think foodies especially really like that. We appreciate knowing where our food is coming from. But I also wrote a book in 2017 about North Dakota beer. And people in North Dakota in general, we appreciate that agricultural component. We appreciate that either because we have friends and family in the, you know, the farming and the ranching industry, or because that's kind of woven into our culture. So that chapter in this book was really a chance to dig down into some of those experiences and talk about, you know, Pride of Dakota, all these products that are made across the state. So many of those, you know, feature local foods, local snacks. You can take a literal taste of North Dakota back with you pretty much from anywhere in the state and online. And I think people are really hungry for that in a world that feels, I don't know, it can feel a little bit the same, right? We're looking for that novelty. We're looking for that local connection. And there's just really fun experiences that you can have too. I mean, I wasn't planning on covering 10-7 acres in Galshoot, but they have a pizza and pancakes, two separate events with alpacas event. And I thought, what?
Wow.
That's so fun. That's so funny. So like, there's all these different experiences where food is kind of woven into not just dining experiences, but, you know, tours of the farm. It's woven into, you know, special dinners and farm tours at Catoota Prairie along the South Dakota border, like these really great farm stays, these really great, even boutique hotels like the Jasper and the Hodo here in Fargo have a food component with them. The Nome Schoolhouse in Nome has a restaurant on site. So even if you're not necessarily a foodie and you're not necessarily seeking out those food experiences to center your time, if you like great hotels, if you like being in nature, if you like farm tours, you're going to get great food too, which I think is a great sign.
I think one of the great things about food is it connects everyone. There's a connection there. Well, it's one of the reasons why I like to do this radio food segment, because we can talk about local foods, bring people together, and it's just one of those things that builds community.
I agree. I think you understand somebody better when you sit across from them. You have a chance to unwind and connect on multiple levels, and I think that gathering is so vital. And I think it's interesting in North Dakota how that happens in many different ways. Like you think about something like Red River Market here in Fargo. Yeah, I can go and I can pop in and out and I can grab some really great local tomatoes that maybe my neighbor grew. But I can also go deeper and I can make time to meet my friends for lunch to try a new vendor that maybe I haven't had a chance to try. Or maybe they're brand new, right? They're trying this out. They don't have a brick and mortar location. They've been coming out for a couple Saturdays. I get to try some interesting new food. We all get to try something together. We're trading ideas. I mean, there's chef demos at those events. It's just a chance to share that meal, to have that conversation, to get talking, and to kind of taste the variety of what's available here. Because I think the thing I learn in my work as a travel writer is that we all get a little stuck sometimes. You know, we take the same route to work. We maybe go the same place on vacation. If we give ourselves permission to take vacation at all, when it comes time to do, you know, date night, we maybe pick the same places. And I think this book, you know, and meals with friends and trading ideas and putting that date to connect with people that you love on your calendar can really help get us out of that rut. And one of my favorite stories about books like this, I wrote a similar book called 100 Things to Do in Fargo Before You Die. And I had an event over at First Avenue Market, and a group of about 4 to 6 women came in and they all bought a book and they just made a beeline for the table. They said, "We saw you on social media. We are always trying to figure out where to go to eat, and we're just going to work our way through this, and then we're going to do other things than just eating." And I thought, brilliant, right? They already knew they wanted to be together. They just needed that extra nudge to make it fun and not an obligation. And I think that is what's so cool, right? Like that little sense of novelty. We often only let ourselves have that when we're on vacation, but we don't have to. We can do it every week, every day if we want.
We're having a great conversation today with Alicia Underlee-Nelson about her new North Dakota travel book called 100 Things to Do in North Dakota Before You Die. Alicia, you've done a lot of research, obviously, for this new book. How can people get a copy?
It's available all over the state. I always encourage people to come to my website if they want an autographed copy. That's prairiestylefile.com, and it's there in the store. So you can see that book as well as the other books that I've written. I've written 3 books on my own and 2 books with friends. So you can get a real idea of the Midwest destinations that I love on that site, and that ships out real quick. It's also available in Fargo at First Avenue Market, Unglued, Overbooked, Vintage Point, and Barnes & Noble. I have an event coming up in Grand Forks next Saturday at Silver Dawn Books, and you can get the book there. It's at Barnes & Noble in Bismarck, where I just had a really, really great book signing on Saturday. Also available in Valley City at Eagle's Nest Books, in Minot at Main Street Books, one of my favorite bookstores in the state, as well as Barnes & Noble, and at Rockin' Relics in Rugby, which I definitely have to book an appointment to go see.
The geographical center of North America.
Indeed, and more to come. So if people want to carry the book, they can certainly reach out to me and do that. And if you have a favorite bookstore, tell me about it, right? You can reach out to me at my website. I love bookstores. I love visiting new places. And maybe they'll want to carry it. Maybe they'll want to do an event and we can meet in person.
So there's travel within these ventures of having these book signings. That's kind of fun.
It's great. I get real life feedback. I learn what people are interested in. And I would say that probably about 15 to 20% of the research for this book came directly from conversations that I had with people when I was selling 100 Things to Do in Fargo Before You Die. So people would say, are you going to write a next one? If you do, you should do this. You should cover this. I like this. Do more of this topic. It's really fun to have conversations with people and to have that, you know, Q&A and get their feedback in real life. And I've got a couple different appearances coming up at libraries. I'm going to be at the Moorhead Public Library this Thursday at 6:30, and then the Fargo Public Library next Monday, the 24th at 6:30. And sometimes library people go even deeper, right? So you'll have a little conversation at a bookstore. People ask you questions, give you their ideas, ask me for specific recommendations, which I really love doing. And then usually at those library visits, people come ready to go. They're planning that trip all the way across the state, and they have serious itinerary questions, and they want to maximize their time. Or even more fun, they're often writers themselves that are looking for some ideas and inspiration to get to the next step. So it's really fun to connect with readers and to learn more about what they want, because that's what makes the books better.
North Dakota is like a big town with long roads, and I think connecting with people is really important, especially when you're writing about food, cultural heritage, all of these different fun spots. I do need to ask you before we go, what motivates you to write these travel books?
I think it started with just curiosity. I think one of the best things we can do in our lives is to really cultivate our curiosity and to really lean into those things that make us stop and go, whoa, what? You know, those things that you, why is that? Where did this come from? Tell me more about that, right? I just started keeping a list of things that I thought were interesting and questions that I had, notes in my phone, notes in my purse. And I realized a lot of those had to do with local businesses, had to do with local food and experiences that were not previously on my radar. So I think this really grew out of a desire to share those ideas. I used to also be a traveling salesperson, so I would always ask other people, other traveling salespeople, and especially truckers like my father-in-law. They know all the good spots. They know the best spots for pie. They know the best cafes to find people. My grandma is in her 90s, still technically selling Tupperware and networking with people, so she had great recommendations. And I thought, here's this wealth of knowledge from smart, interesting people. They would direct me to the first interesting spot, and then I would talk to the barista or talk to the coffee shop owner or talk to the server or talk to the person selling me the books, and they would have another idea. So a lot of these ideas that I'm gathering, I'm just giving voice to what other smart people are already telling me, other cool places that are already happening. So lean into your curiosity, and whether you put that in book form or a magazine article, as I often do, or whether you share that on social media or, you know, however you put that information out there. I think if we all lean into that, the world is a better place.
Well, thank you for the encouragement. Where can people find you? Talked a little bit about a website earlier with the list of book signings and events, but where can people find you? Website, social media?
Prairie Style File on Instagram and on Facebook, and that's the best way to find me there. And my website is prairiestylefile.com. It also works pretty well, if you forget that, to just Google Alicia Underlie Nelson, and I show up because I'm the only one.
Alicia Underlie Nelson, thanks for coming in today to talk about your new book, 100 Things to Do in North Dakota Before You Die.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Yon. We'll talk to you next week.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. As the Fargo-Moorhead diversion nears completion, officials are working to make sure farmers upstream aren't left paying the price when the flood control project is put to use.
The concept is we got to work with everybody, and nothing's perfect, but we got to do our best to be fair to everybody.
Well, hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back to Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast here from Prairie Public. What is on the beat this week, Danielle?
Well, I wanted to get into the issue of the Fargo-Moorhead diversion a little bit. We reported on that a little bit already this week. It might feel a little weird to be talking about flood control when everything is so dry and crispy out there right now, but this has been a project that's been in the works for a long time, and next year it will finally be ready.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to think about. Now, I wasn't here during the 2009 flood, which of course was pretty dramatic and made a mythical figure out of Mayor Dennis Wallacher and the citizens of Fargo and Moorhead that saved the city, basically. Now, Grand Forks, I was there during the flood of 1997, and, you know, they developed their own flood control system, which works pretty well, involving a lot of flood walls and things like that. But after all this time, the Fargo-Moorhead area will finally have its flood control project ready to go. That is a massively big deal.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for a lot of people who live within the city limits around here, you know, where we are, it's easier to not really think about it much because you can't really see the work that's been going on. But if you do venture out of town or you go out on the highway, you're able to see, you know, the overpasses that have been constructed, the control structures, just how wide and tall those diversion channels are. It's pretty incredible. And of course, before it ever got to the point where they broke ground in the first place, it took a lot of planning, a lot of engineering, a lot of legislating, and cooperation among a lot of different stakeholders, including landowners.
Yeah, absolutely. The private landowners certainly are feeling the biggest impacts of this.
Yes. So this week, I went out to a farm just outside of Horace. There was a news conference there with North Dakota's senior senator, John Hoven, Fargo's new mayor, Josh Boucher, and executive director of the Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Authority, Jason Benson, was there as well. And they were highlighting some legislation Senator Hoven has been working on to make sure those farmers upstream of the diversion are compensated for their cooperation during flood events. It's addressing crop insurance, which is a farmer's biggest risk management tool. So I'll have him explain it here for you.
Why do we have to address that? Well, it's because crop insurance is designed to address challenges that Mother Nature gives us, not man-made challenges, okay? And so it doesn't work when you introduce man-made challenges, meaning if water's backed up on this area, roughly 30,000 acres of prime farmland, give or take, if the diversion backs water up there and impacts those crops, that doesn't trigger crop insurance. That's not fair. That's why we have to address it.
Well, it seems pretty reasonable. If the landowners had to consent to this project impacting their business, there should be something in place to make them whole again.
Exactly. So what he's done is he's worked some provisions into the Senate version of the Farm Bill, and it's a two-part plan. Last year, they were able to pass legislation that directed $100 million to the Diversion Authority from the Corps of Engineers to be used as a cost share for this purpose.
What the Diversion Authority is doing is taking $25 million of that $100 million, actuarially calculated, to cover those losses, which they will then pay to the farmers whose crops are impacted by that flooding.
So the money is there, and that's good. But when you think of insurance, and I'm sure this is how crop insurance must work too, like all other insurance, if you make a claim and get a payout, that might affect your future premiums, right?
Actually, yes. So, I mean, we've all probably had a story like that. Just anecdotally, for example, my husband had a rock in his windshield last year, and we were kind of, you know, just debating over that. Like, do we want to pay a deductible, make that claim, and risk having our insurance go up? Or should we just kind of, you know, try to get a good deal somewhere at a glass shop in town and just eat that cost and not have to deal with higher premiums, stuff like that. So the same thing goes for farmers. A producer has something called an annual production yield, which goes into something called their actual production history, or APH. And it uses up to 10 years of historical yields to determine crop insurance guarantees. So when you get those crop insurance payouts, it can affect your future coverage. So the other part of this legislation addresses that.
I've included legislation, which would be number 18 when we get it passed, that says those years will not count in these farmers' annual production history, meaning that that doesn't, in essence, go into their track record. Otherwise, they would have to pay more premium in order to get the same level of coverage. They would be penalized every year where they're impacted.
Well, sounds pretty good to me, except for the part, I guess, that the farm bill, surprise, surprise, has not yet been passed.
Yeah, it's 3 years late. So I did ask Senator Hovind about that, too, about, you know, how do you feel about the possibility of getting this farm bill finished and soon? He says he's optimistic and he feels pretty good about it. He's like, you know, we got to get everybody to work together, especially work across the aisle. Compromise needs to get into the House version. So that sort of work is going on federally at this point with the flood control project. One other thing I wanted to make sure that we highlight as well with this issue is, you know, some of the local work that's happening in the event of a flood. Fargo Mayor Josh Boucher talked about that at the news conference, too. He says there are two local committees that are assigned to this.
The first of all is the crop loss program, which about a month ago we set up, and we'll be putting together a team to monitor the investment of that $25 million so we make sure that it continues to produce to be available for when an incident or when we decide to activate the diversion. And then the second is the Land Management Committee, which is looking at the Debris Removal and Restoration Subcommittee, which this will ensure that if something happens, we're making plans now that we're able to quickly remove debris, make sure that your land that's been impacted is able to be cleared as quickly as possible and have plans and contingencies in place so that we're not figuring out as we go, but we have plans in place well ahead of the operation of the diversion.
Well, there's just so much to consider with a project of this size, this magnitude, more than just the cost and the design, but so many other questions along the way. It really sounds like they're trying to be as thorough as they can, and even though it will be ready to go next spring, hopefully it's not something we have to rely on very often.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But yeah, for those of us who were here in 2009, it is really a great relief to know that this will be here if we need it. It's been such a long time coming. And since it has been so dry, you know, and a milder winter is probably what we're looking at here this year, it's not likely we will be in dire need of the diversion next spring, but it will be here when we do need it.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I saw a YouTube video, maybe you saw it too, that some content creator influencer out there did on the diversion and just the amount of bridges. I forget, it was in the teens that were built around the FM area. Just that alone, I mean, it's a big project just to build one bridge over any body of water, but just the deepening of this channel and then all these bridges, it's incredible
all the
amount
of
work.
All the dirt that they had to move.
All the dirt, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, wow, what a project. And like you said, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind because it's going around the city and not very populated places that you could see. It's just only when you head out of town and you cross over a bridge, you're like, oh, I guess they're making some progress on this. And it is about done in Fargo, like our big city neighbors to the way north, Winnipeg, will have protection year-round from the mighty Red River of the North. Thanks for that, Danielle. What else is going on in Z Newsroom this week?
Well, next month, North Dakota's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is updating which items can be purchased with EBT cards. It's aiming at helping people make healthier choices. We've alluded to this a little already this episode, but yesterday, Governor Armstrong declared a drought disaster in the state, activating an emergency response plan.
Personally, I think if you pay your debt to society and you serve your sentence, should be let out.
And there is a special session of the legislature coming up in a couple of weeks. We're going to have a lot of issues being discussed during that. One story that's been really big, you know, related to that was one lawmaker, Senator Megrim, was proposing that two federal inmates serving life in prison for the deaths of two U.S. Marshals back in 1983 be given clemency. But that proposal was defeated during a meeting of legislative management this week.
Yeah, and I would guess pretty unanimously.
Yes.
Looking at that on the surface, I didn't think it would probably get very far, and yeah, I guess it has not. So lots going on in North Dakota, and we'll be keeping our eyes on that with the weeks and days to come. What's left of the summer anyway? Thanks to you guys on the news team for staying on top of everything.
You bet. So be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news, or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that's all, folks, for us this week on Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can hear Prairie Beat every Wednesday on Main Street and anytime you'd like when you subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts. Still ahead on Main Street, after losing her infant son, Henry, Jen Burgard founded Haven to ensure families never have to walk alone. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Pregnancy and infant loss can bring profound grief and an isolation made worse when friends and family members don't know what to say or how to help. This October, 12 runners will carry a message of remembrance and hope nearly 480 miles across North Dakota. The 1015 Project begins October 15th in Medora and concludes October 18th in West Fargo. Along the way, the runners will pass through communities including Dickinson, Bismarck, and Jamestown, and each mile will honor babies gone too soon and the families who carry their memories. The relay will also raise awareness and financial support for Haven, a nonprofit that provides resources, connection, and compassionate support to people navigating pregnancy and infant loss. Joining us to discuss the 1015 Project is Jen Burgard, project visionary and the founder of Haven, the beneficiary of the 1015 Project. Jen, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Very pleased that you are with us today and you can share with listeners what you're trying to do. And before we talk about the relay itself, what would you like listeners to understand about pregnancy and infant loss and the grief that many families carry long after it occurs?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to start any other way than to at least mention the reason that I got into what I'm doing. And that really is because in 2017, we had unexpectedly lost our son shortly after birth to a very rare complication. And at the time of my son Henry's death, I thought that this didn't happen anymore. I thought that this is the 21st century. We are beyond that as far as medicine goes. And it wasn't until I spent some time alone without my baby healing at home that I realized that this actually affects one in four pregnancies end in loss, right? I mean, this isn't one in four families, it's one in four pregnancies. And it just shattered my thoughts about all of these preconceived notions that I had, right? And so then I thought there must be so many people out there that are doing things, I can find support, and then I couldn't. And I'm here in Fargo, North Dakota, and I looked for opportunities and other people to connect with, and it was really difficult to find something that really fit what I needed. And so Haven really came about because I wanted to offer something that wasn't available to me and that I believe should be to families moving forward. And as it turns out, families who had come before me. So that's really where it all started.
That one in four statistic is really surprising to me.
It is. It's surprising to a lot of people, I think. And then, you know, if you do the math there, you know, we serve all of North Dakota and then also into Minnesota. So the number of births and pregnancies in this state, right? That's a lot. It's a lot of pregnancies.
The relay is called the 1015 Project. What's the significance of that name?
So for those that don't know, October is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month, with October 15th being Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day, a day, again, I had no idea about until I was in that circumstance. And now it's a day that lost families like me and so many other hold sort of almost in veneration, just because we're all remembering a wave of light occurs on that day for anyone who knows. And that's why we chose that date to start. And we thought the western part of the state in Medora would be a beautiful place to begin to honor those babies.
What do you hope a grieving parent or family hears in the message behind the project? And I want to make sure that I state family, because oftentimes we have brothers and sisters, or we have grandparents that are certainly tightly, lovingly involved in this grief and this loss.
Absolutely. Number one, our message is always to make sure that they know they're not alone, that they know there are other people out there who are willing to help carry that burden of grief with them. We all know that many hands makes a lighter load. And so that really is a big part of that mission. And then secondly, that this happens. It happens to someone you know. Everybody knows someone that has experienced this devastating type of grief, right? And so we want them to know that it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to say their names. It's okay to, you know, just send a message and say, hey, I'm thinking about you and your baby, and share that baby's name with them again. It all matters, and it all is so important.
Why do you think silence and isolation so often surround these experiences? You talk about how it's okay. And I think if we all step back and thought about it, we would realize it's okay to talk about it, but oftentimes we don't.
Yeah, I think there's two factors there. One, from the grieving person's side, is often, unfortunately and unfairly, there is a sense of shame and guilt that goes along with it. We're often met with, were you paying attention? Did you feel different movement? Did you eat something you weren't supposed to? Were you exercising too much? Were you exercising too little? Were you eating too much, eating too little? Right? There's a lot there. And I think there's so many rules and guidelines, and which are wonderful for best practice when it comes to pregnancy. But when things go wrong, sometimes there's no answer, and there's no reason that we can identify today with the signs that we have why it went wrong. So women often are left with a blame space that is on themselves, right? You're a mom. You have mother's instinct. You should know something's wrong, right? So there's a lot of just cultural things that I think are placed on women. And that's why sometimes women don't share that this happened to them. And then from the other perspective, I think folks out in the public, those who are supportive, family and friends and things like that, they don't know what to say,
yeah.
Right? They're like, if I say something, is it going to make it worse? Am I going to say something wrong? Am I going to offend them? Am I going to make them cry? Right? They're going through a whole mental thing also, right? So you get those two facets together, we're not going to find a good place to have an open and honest conversation.
Are there common responses that, however well-intended, can make grief more difficult?
Yes, there are. And I will say this, I'll preface this by saying I always like to share things that we could say rather than what we shouldn't say, because I think we get scared, right? Where they say, well, don't say this, and don't say this, and don't say this. And it's like, okay, I'm not saying anything, right? But saying nothing is the worst thing of all, right? So I think any phrase that starts with at least is maybe just throw that out. We'll skip that one. The most common one, I think, is at least you can get pregnant. At least you can have another baby, you know. And while it coming off, it feels like a nice thing to say, but I think it's only making the person who says it feel better and not the person who's receiving it. So what I always opt for is say, if they gave baby a name, start with baby's name, right? Say baby's name is Macy. You know, Macy is beautiful. She's a beautiful baby. She will be missed. I can't even fathom what you're going through. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Could I bring over dinner tonight? I'm just going to leave some coffee at your door. You know, I think just being proactive with families and just saying, hey, I'm here. I'd love to hear anything you want to tell me about your baby. Things like that, right? Something that you would say to someone who's maybe even grieving the loss of a parent, a grandparent, a sibling, a friend. I think grieving families just want their babies to get the same respect that any other person who has passed away gets. So
what I hear you're saying is certainly you need to remember mom, but you should also remember dad.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dad is grieving in the same way. Absolutely. I think a common story too is dad or partner head back to work and they say, well, how is your partner? How's the mom? How's she doing? How's your wife? Right. But no one's asking him how he's doing. Right. And so I think taking time for that is really important too, because dads grieve too. They may grieve differently, but they're certainly grieving right alongside.
I think we've all heard that couples struggle perhaps after something like this happens. Are you able to support not only friends with mom and friends with dad and family with mom and family with dad, but mom and dad together as that couple?
We are. We strive to do that. We strive to host events that not only that moms can attend, but opportunities for mom and dad to attend together. Typically, specifically, I will say our remembrance events are really important, that we make sure we have space and it makes sense for both mom and dad. And to be totally transparent, it's tougher to get the dads in a room, right, and get them talking. But we have had success with that. We try to include things in our healing gifts that we send out as an organization when we know there is a father in the picture. We try to send something out that's catered towards them as well. So.
Joining my conversation with Jen Burgard. She's a project visionary and the founder of Haven, who's the beneficiary of the 1015 project. We're going to talk a little bit more about that relay in just a minute, but I want to learn more about Haven. How does the organization actually help families then navigate life after pregnancy or infant loss? What do you do?
First thing that we started doing was providing healing gifts. And what these are bags that have very important resources that families can find, whether it's in person locally, whether it's online, whether it's regional resources, lists, things that are relevant to their specific loss, and sometimes even down to the point of gestation of their losses. We also include comfort items that are encouraging families to take care of themselves, to just be mindful, and different things to keep their hands busy. If there are other living siblings in the family, we include things for them as well, including gift cards for ice cream or Starbucks gift cards. All the things that basically I could have used in my grief journey and that other moms and dads have come to me and said, oh, someone got us this and it was great. Would you check it out and see if this fits for your gifts? Absolutely. Every single thing that's put in there is something that has been requested by another family.
How do you then continue the relationship? And it's not just a one-off, I'm sure.
It's not. So the second thing that this gift serves as is really an invitation. It's an invitation into this community of support, into this network of people that just get it, that understand, right? And they can connect with us via social media, online. We have events that we host regularly here in town. We have, for example, a wreath making class that we host around the Christmas time, right? That we have Mother's Day. We have a Mother's Day floral workshop where moms can come in and make their own floral arrangement for Mother's Day. Right? No mom should be forgotten on Mother's Day, right? Let alone a mom who has lost a child. Mm-hmm. So we host those types of events. We have a monthly support group that is led by a professional facilitator. We have a podcast called Landscape of Loss, where we share stories of loss and perspectives on surviving grief and navigating what that looks like. So we have a lot of different facets of support. We like to try to make sure that we're meeting people in a lot of different ways that they find helpful. We know that it's not feasibly possible for people to always connect in person. So hence the podcast and some other things like that.
I'll mention this again at the end, but you can find more information at the 1015project.org, the 1015project.org, to learn all about what's happening. The relay, it begins October 15th, as we mentioned,
yes,
and ends in West Fargo. How will the 12 runners cover that 480 miles in 4 days? Holy smokes.
One at a time, right? No, you know, these runners are I'm going to call them elite athletes because I'm not a runner myself, right? Like these guys are putting in the miles, and some of them are used to running 100-mile races. Some of them are like lacing up these sneakers fresh. Like they're going to do this. They're training from beginning to end. So we have a variety, but the one thing that really ties them all together is they all really, really deeply care about the mission and about spreading awareness about pregnancy and infant loss. So they'll start, we're going to have a couple RVs trekking along with these folks the entire way, some SUVs starting in Medora, and literally 1 mile at a time, probably, I don't know what minute miles they're doing, 6 minute miles maybe.
And they're doing 480 of them. Holy cow.
Yeah, and 480 about all night, all day, one at a time. Yeah.
How will babies and families then, which are at the heart of the project, be represented and then remembered along the route?
So what we really are trying to do is make sure that we're carrying those stories along with us, right? I think everybody, all of the visionaries that are involved in the project have babies that they're remembering. At the end, the goal is to have a very public display of several infants and children who have been lost, and that we can have a wall or something that we can share and put those names up there.
The route, as we mentioned, passes through some of the larger communities in North Dakota, Dickinson, Bismarck, Jamestown. How can people participate when the relay comes through the area?
Yeah, we have events actually that are setting up at each of those locations, and it'll be for a few hours at each of those spots at, like you said, Dickinson, Bismarck, Jamestown. So watch for information on our website and our social media, especially we'll be announcing all of those events that are taking place in those communities. If you want to help, if you're a parent who has lost a child and you want to get involved, or you just care a lot, I love that. Just reach out to 1015 Project, and there is a contact us form, and you can put your name down as a volunteer. They will reach out to you, and we will get that all sorted for what you can help and what you can do. So there's a lot of spots for help.
You would like to hear from folks that didn't just maybe lose a loved one, a child or a grandchild this year, but mm-hmm. even maybe years and years and years ago, you still Absolutely. Would like to hear from them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because what I know, right, is that, and all of us know as grieving parents, is that we don't forget. We grieve this loss until I'm 9 years out. I still grieve the loss of my son. I still look at my kids now and look at my family now and say, oh, this should be. It should be something different. It really should. And, you know, that's hard. And there's not a lot of people that get that except the people who've gone through it. So the beautiful thing about these events is that you're going to meet other families and other people that are going through what you're going through. And you're going to be able to finally have a conversation out loud and say your kid's name out loud and not get kind of a weird blank stare mm-hmm. back. It's hard to describe, but if anyone who's lost a child is listening, they get it. They get it.
How can folks help support monetarily or otherwise?
A number one, check out our runners. We have a runner page. Find a runner to love is one thing I will absolutely say. They each have their own giving pages. So you can give directly to each of you. If you're like, hey, I'm from Bismarck. Is there anyone running from Bismarck? There sure is. So check that out. The runners would love to connect with you. If you want them to hold someone in their heart while they're running, reach out to them. They would love to do that. Secondly, if you're a business and you want to get involved, whether it's in kind helping with water or food or snacks or whatever it is, or volunteers, let us know. We love that. This is an opportunity, I think, for statewide visibility. Right. So there's not a lot of situations, I think, that you're going to get this kind of visibility in a nonprofit event. Right. So it's going to be a big deal. So I think we truly value our partnerships and our sponsors. And I think you'll see that. So there's definitely room to get involved from that perspective. And then just coming out to the events, it's going to be fun. They're going to be fun events. They're going to be family friendly. Everyone is welcome in the community. We've got colleges reaching out. We've got schools reaching out that are like, how can we partner with you? How do we get our track team involved? You know, so it's going to be something else.
The 1215 Project will bring those 12 runners nearly 480 miles across North Dakota and will begin October 15th in Medora and conclude October 18th in West Fargo. The relay will honor Babies Gone Too Soon, while raising awareness and support for families experiencing pregnancy and infant loss. You certainly can learn more about the runners, as Jen just let us know. And you can follow the relay, find community events, and support Haven at the 1015project.org. Jen Burgard, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the memory of Henry and the work that you're doing moving forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Craig. I appreciate you.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 19th. Wolves once thrived in North Dakota. Early settlers considered them a danger to livestock and to the settlers themselves. In the late 19th century, eradication efforts largely drove them out of the state. Local governments began offering bounties on wolves, and in 1893, the Emmons County Record reported that the county board approved paying wolf bounties. The 1897 state legislature considered wolves a serious threat and voted to institute bounties statewide. Hunters received $3 for a gray wolf. The legislature called the situation an emergency, and the record of that meeting states, "An emergency exists, therefore this act shall be in full force and effect." The state's wolf population began to decline in the late 1800s because of a combination of factors. Intensive hunting and trapping, loss of habitat, and government bounties combined to drive wolves out of their traditional territory. Wolves are skilled pack hunters and can bring down large game like elk and even bison. But human activity reduced their food sources. The wolf population plummeted as human settlement and agricultural activities altered the landscape. As cars began traveling the roads, crisscrossing the state, wolves were sometimes killed in vehicle collisions. On this date in 1912, the Bismarck Daily Tribune announced that South Dakota was decreasing its wolf bounty. Hunters would receive about $2 less. This was due to a combination of factors. The state budget was one concern, but wolves were simply no longer the immediate threat they had once been. Wolves are occasionally seen in North Dakota today, but their presence is mainly transient, with no established breeding population. They tend to travel through the state as they move between the robust wolf populations in Canada and Minnesota. Wolves passing through are usually younger animals seeking their own territories. Confirmed sightings are rare, but they have increased since the 1980s. Sightings are most common in areas adjacent to Minnesota and Manitoba. A pack of six wolves was recently spotted at the J. Clark Saylor Wildlife Refuge in north central North Dakota. The gray wolf is currently listed as an endangered species under the Federal Endangered Species Act throughout North Dakota. This federal designation provides the highest level of protection, making it illegal to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, or kill a wolf. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
The U.S. war with Iran is approaching the six-month mark, yet President Trump says he has no plans to continue talks with Iran. Where does that leave U.S. allies in the Gulf? Meanwhile, Trump insists the Strait of Hormuz remains open and operating, but what's actually happening there? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, a closer look with the monitor. Artificial intelligence is already changing North Dakota classrooms, but should schools regulate how students use AI, or should lawmakers focus on the companies creating it? That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.